Hey everybody, this is Justin Case, and this is another episode of Pod Rock, episode 7. And with me is my faithful and friendly co-host, Mr. Ben Stape.
How's it going?
And tonight we're going to be talking about heavily about Queensryche and maybe going through their discography and also discussing maybe some of the things that may resonate with me, and Ben will definitely be talking about things that resonate with him about the band, particular songs, which albums really, aspects of their different albums, which is a quite extensive catalog. And if you've ever seen them live, it's always a treat because they've got a long list of songs to pick from, and they, you know, it's always nice when you can see any band that can. Well, I always think it's neat when a band has one album, their debut album, which is really good, and they just play the whole thing through, which is awesome. I know Godsmack did that, and you really got your money's worth. Their segment alone is like 2 minutes long, or two hours long. But anyway, it's not about them tonight. Tonight's about Queensryche. And Ben, I'm going to turn this over to you, Lickety Split, to do the news.
Yeah, so awesome. Awesome stuff in the news. I don't know if you've had a chance to kind of pay attention. I know some life events for you have kind of changed, keeping you from maybe diving in a bit more than I have. But it's looking like touring is going to start up, and a lot of major bands are booking shows starting in August of this year. A lot of great bands that you probably want to see, haven't seen. I'm not going to go through the whole entire list, but definitely go out and check and see if your bands are scheduling, because some of them are. To me, that's exciting because there's nothing better than seeing music live. You really get an appreciation for the band, what they're trying to say, how they're trying to convey their music, and you just get that. I mean, that live ambiance, it's irreplaceable, in my opinion. Some other news, Michael Wagner announced his retirement. I know it's been a couple weeks. He's a producer and mixer and engineer for people like Alice Cooper, Metallica, Skid Row, Warrant, Motley Crue, Dokken. Quite the extraordinary list. I thought that was definitely worth talking about and bringing up. Speaking of tours, Styx and Collective Soul are going to do a tour together.
What?
Styx,
my gosh.
Yeah, wow. Styx has been around for a while. I thought it was interesting they decided to go with Collective Soul of all bands. And then to kind of go into the topic du jour for tonight, Operation Mindcrime was released 33 years ago on May 3rd from Queensryche. So I thought, hey, why not talk about that? They're one of my influential bands in my life. So as Justin has said, we're going to talk about them. So we can start diving into it. I've been a fan myself probably since the Mindcrime Empire-ish albums came out, is when I was exposed to them. So I got I got the cream of the crop as far as the discs go and the music goes. Really good time to get into the band. They were just on point, hitting their stride musically, I think, when Mindcrime came out, and it didn't get as much notoriety as Empire did. But to me, the band was kind of quintessential for me, my playing, getting into music, diving into it more. It definitely challenged my ears at the age that I was at. Chris DeGarmo and Mike Wilton, the two lead guitarists at the time on those albums. I think they're just one of those dynamic duels that duos. God, I can't even speak tonight. That they stand out as high up there as you can. I know that there's other bands out there that have two guitar players that play leads, they play duet leads, but to me, they really kind of took the craft and took it to another level. They've obviously gone through changes and lineup changes. We'll get into that tonight, too. I guess the first question I have and want to talk about, as you were talking about the extensive catalog, I know you've had a chance to listen to some of their music in the past. You've kind of dived into one of their earlier albums, which I would say would be more their creative side, where they kind of branched out a bit. Which albums stood out to you?
I like Empire and An Operation, you know, myself. But I really liked Q2K was really good too. I mean, to be more in the more modern end of things, but I was pleasantly surprised too when I listened to Q2K, And that's when Kelly Gray was in the band, I believe.
Yeah, that was his first album.
Yeah, I remember listening to it, and man, I was like, wow, this is pretty good. But yeah, Eyes of a Stranger is like my favorite Queensryche song, and I had actually forgotten about it. And because, you know, I was all about Empire, you know, because I like the whole album. And particularly, if you listen to Mindcrime and you listen to Empire, there's definitely a higher end production value to Empire, right? But having said that, if you listen to Operation Mindcrime, that sound that they get is very, it sounds very raw, is guess what I'm trying to say, but it's still, the songs are still very, very well put together and arranged, and the recordings are very good. And it felt like to me that they were really pushing the natural power tube distortion of their amps, like they're just raging, right? But they're not doing a lot of, they're not using a lot of like pedals and stuff. It's a lot of it is just pure tone, and I thought it was great. And I you'd sent me a YouTube clip of the making of, and I thought that was great because you see kind of like them, their personalities back in, you know, that time period in the mid 80s there, and it's like they already had an idea what they wanted to do, but they were also experimenting at the same time, and it was very refreshing to see. In, you know, the style of that album, you can't really put them in a category because it wasn't like the quote unquote hair metal. It was, they were doing their own thing, you know.
Yeah.
They just happened to be a rock band, but were doing things very much their own interpretation. And I can honestly tell you that I can't find a single album by another band that I could compare it to where it's like, oh, it's just like, it's like that or similar to. No, I can't. I honestly can't.
Yeah, their concept album, Operation Mindcrime, I think there's been a lot of different concept albums out there. Pink Floyd's The Wall is another one that comes to mind when you think about a whole entire album based off a story, right? And I think when you listen to The Wall, it's got all those same kind of flavors, but I think you're right. I think Operation Mindcrime kind of took it to a little bit more of that rock and roll feel. Definitely, if you had a chance to see them live when they played all the way through it, that storyline that goes along with it is pretty cool. It's a pretty, it's the concept of it, you know, with a character that is drawn into this revolution and his trials and tribulations with drugs and women and all for a cause, right? Was a pretty interesting concept. And you're right. I can't see, at least off the top of my head, I can't think of another concept album that really kind of fits into that same schema. You know, the progressive rock side of what they do and what they write, I think, is definitely highlighted. And you could see kind of where they were going with the Rage for Order album, where the first two that they had, the EP they put out in The Warning, they had more of the, you know, the metal, you know, British metal type of flavor to their writing style. With a bit of that prog rock in there. But I think, like I said, the Rage for Order album really, I think, pushed them out into the prog rock arena, because Rage for Order to me is the album that they really got super creative with, right? They tried a whole bunch of different types of keys to play music in. It wasn't just straight power chords. They really kind of broadened out the diversity of the guitar tracks and what they were playing, which just carried on into, you know, Operation Mindcrime, and then of course Empire, you know, another huge, huge smash album that has a ton of tracks on it. That's really good. That's really great.
Now, you said you've got the expanded version of Empire, correct?
Yeah, they had some extra tracks on there that they didn't put on the album.
Scarborough Fair is an awesome. I love Jeff Tate's vocals on that.
Yeah. Dirty Little Secret was on there, Scarborough Fair. You know, there's bands that can cover tunes and they sound okay. There's ones they cover it and it sounds just meh. You know, can tell
these
it's
guys
cover.
Made it their own. These guys
exactly. Yeah, they took that song and they nailed it, and they took what they do and they implemented that into the song, and it just fit. I was blown away when I heard that track.
Yeah.
The intro of it was definitely, you know, it reminds you of the Simon and Garfunkel song, right? It's kind of got that folksy kind of feel to it. And then when they just smash into it with the distorted guitars, you know, it just took it to that next level of like, oh my
Yeah.
gosh, yeah. Now you're not just covering a song. Now you're covering a song, right? And you're making it your own when it sounds amazing. Yeah, I can't say enough about that track. It's really good. And
Yeah,
once again, oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say I was glad that you had me listen to Rage for because, you know, it's aside from Eyes of a Stranger, I never really listened to it before. I kind of forgot about that album. And but I mean, obviously, like I listened to their, you know, their work before that was very Iron Maiden-esque influence, you know, kind of thing, and it was interesting. And then, but you see them go from that to their own animal, which is quite a transformation. And I could tell you that just to talk a little bit about some of Michael Wilton's gear, he had an awesome website in the mid 2000s, and he had this gallery of all his signature ESP guitars, and he had some limited guitars in there, and it just, wow, I was just enthralled by how cool those guitars are. And it's neat in seeing them live. I saw them live in 2000, and he had his skull guitar there, and he was playing Jet City Woman, and see him do that, you know, that climactic solo, you know. And it's just really cool to be able to see them live. And they had Kelly Gray was in the band playing guitar, and they sounded okay. Their set list was, it was underwhelming because, like, Rob Halford was the opening act, right? And he was doing his solo album, which was just, I mean, Rob Halford has an amazing stage presence. Like, you're like, oh, yeah, that guy's on a stage. Everybody just get out of the way. And it's a metal concert. It's a metal. It's a classic metal type of atmosphere. And I remember Jeff Tate gets on the microphone and he says, for one reason today, metal. Right. And I'm like, yeah, it's going to be great. You know, maybe they pulled some of their heavier songs. And then they played stuff off Q2K. And it didn't match very well with, like, frickin' Iron Maiden and, you know, the Judas Priest-type styles of Rob Halford. And now, I will tell you that Jeff Tate, obviously, and is it, you know, they were, there's that connection there, right? But, and just kind of like the British power metal stuff, like early power metal stuff. And that album just did not fit with the other two bands for that outing. If they would have played some of their older stuff, it would have been perfect, but it was just their song selection. I remember was they just stuck to like the 90s hits, you know, and I was like, God, guys, what are you thinking? You guys could really just totally destroy the place if you want to. And so but it was an interesting set list and very underwhelming is what I remember. And I just, yeah, that was a little odd. I was kind of a little underwhelmed performance that day, but Michael Wilton was great. Michael Wilton was awesome. I think Jeff Tate's voice started at that point because, I mean, that was 20 years ago, but I remember that.
It was different. Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, he couldn't hit the screaming banshee stuff that
he used to hit. Yeah. I think some of that, too, changed when Chris DeGarmo left the band. And this is just kind of my humble opinion about it. And I'm sure some people might disagree. They could agree. I don't know. But when you take one of the main songwriters out of a band, and then you try to replace it with another person that writes, you're just going to get a different flavor. You know, you're going to get a different style. Not to say that Mike Wilton didn't bring stuff to the table, but it was an interesting time for the band in general, because they had been together for a while, the early 80s. And, you know, here at the end of the 90s, they kind of started changing their songwriting. And that's along when grunge kind of came out too. Their Here and Now Frontier album, that they released after after Promised Land, didn't get as much notoriety and airplay because it was really stripped down and raw. It didn't have a lot of the same flavor back and forth, you know, from the guitars and bass and drum tracks that you would come to expect from Queensryche on most of their albums. And after that album release, is when Chris decided to just walk away and leave the business. There's a lot of speculation behind why he left. There's never been any real comment from Chris on why he left. I have my own personal thoughts on that. Just when you get into a band, you know, at the beginning when you're young and you have, five guys in it that aren't married, that kind of start growing together. They get married. They kind of have this tight-knit family, right? And not just necessarily the players that play the music, but then their wives, they meet, obviously, they're involved with each other. And after the Empire tour, they were on tour a long time. They had a chance to be able to kind of step back and take some time off. And I think it was like 8 months before they even started writing more material. And when they did, it wasn't together as a band. They were kind of writing individually. And Chris, I think, was the glue to the band at that time. I think he got everybody together, especially with the Promised Land album. He was like, we're going to go rent an island and go record out there for 6 months to get away from your families, get away from everything else that we've been spending 8 months away from the band doing. And I think when you get to a point where you start having to become, like a parent in essence of, okay, guys, we got to be here by this time, right? Hey, we got to do this by this time. Hey, I'm going to start taking on all the responsibility of the fan club, the legal aspects of what's going on with the band. Because I think, I want to say after Promised Land, EMI label, I think went kaput or they dropped them. I don't remember exactly what it was, but you've got one guy handling everything, the whole band, and that's a lot to take on, right? When you don't have a lot of people participating. So
Yeah.
I think, when you look at the writing credits and you see, from the beginning, you have everybody's input, people are writing songs are ending up on the album, and then you get into Mindcrime and everybody's, I mean, they're clicking, everybody's writing, everybody's inputting. But you see that Chris DeGarmo is a main influence on a ton of those records and a ton of those songs. And by the time you get up to Here and Now Frontier, the majority of songs were written by Chris. So, and like I said, this is my personal view on it, just from looking from the outside. I don't know these guys. It'd be great to meet them. It'd be great to meet Chris because I think he's an amazing songwriter. I think he just has a knack and a flavor for finding chords, finding musical connections on a guitar in places that, man, it inspired me. It really does, and it still does when I listen to those albums. Going back to the topic I was talking about, I think you get to a point where you don't want to have to be the guy to drag everybody to the table. You want these people to be hungry enough that they want to participate because this is what they want to do. And when you have to start dragging people in, it becomes, kind of a burden. And then you add in people's wives are leaving, they're getting divorces, so your family, in essence, is breaking up, right? And then you're bringing in new people. Jeff Tate got remarried. I think somebody else had gotten a divorce at the time. And I think that's when the dynamics really started changing around the band. And I think Chris was just like, okay, you know what? I've been leading this band. I don't need anybody else, really kind of from outside of the band telling what to do and how to do it. And I think some of those outside influences were starting to breach in, right?
Right.
There was, like you said, the Q2K album was the first one that they did after Here and Now Frontier without Chris, and I think that's why you noticed the change in style. It went more to kind of a rock, not a metal. It wasn't progressive rock by any means, and they went to more of a drop D tuning that Kelly Gray, is kind of known for in his style of writing and playing.
Well, but the thing is, like, Here in the Now Frontier, that album was, what was that, like, their least successful album, wasn't it? It wasn't well received.
No, in fact, I think if I remember correctly, Wilton only had one credit and one song on that album. It was the only album that Chris DeGarmo actually sang the primary vocals on. It's a song with piano in it. So I kind of tend to think that it was probably the fact that Chris was just pushing, like, hey, we're Queensryche, we need to write something, we need to keep doing this. This was something that he was involved with, and I think that, it became to where he was just kind of dragging the band along with him, which is why I think there was a huge gap between Q2K and Here and Now Frontier. I think, what, 97 when Here and Now Frontier came out? And then you didn't get another Queensryche album for almost 3, 4 years.
Yeah, I've got a stack of Metal Edge magazines at my old room in New York, And I remember reading the article when Q2K came out and they were talking about hearing an out frontier and everything, and Jeff Tate was really talking up like Kelly Gray and like, well, that you know that album this that and the other, but now we got there were we have a much better feel about this one and we're really digging blah, blah blah. And I was like, okay, I'm not the connoisseur of Queensrÿche, but you kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's always when you introduce a different lineup, it's going to be sound. It sound different. And you're going to always run the risk of like, all right, how it, will it be received? But it seems like to me, especially in the, like there was, I could see the factions in that type of, in that interview, it was the Kelly Gray, Jeff Tate versus the band kind of most. And that's my perspective as a reader. What do I know? But, and you know, I was like 20 years old when I read that article and it was like, then they were going to be doing that tour, and I saw them on the tour for, to support that album. And I just like, this isn't the Queensrÿche that I was hoping to see. You know, when I was a kid and I'd hear their stuff on the radio, I'd be like 10 years old, and you know, I'd hear all those great tunes from Empire, and you know, it's like, this isn't the band. This isn't what I was hoping they would be, you know. And because this the song sounds so big because they've got that production and they've got string section. They're one of the original bands that was a main. Well, a lot of bands in that point were doing string sections, but they were doing it just to say they had a string section. Queensrÿche did it in a way that was artistic that fit the songs they were. And there was a lot of copycat stuff going on in the early '90s. And I think a lot of that stuff they stole from Queensrÿche, honestly. Because a lot of the biggest bands are rip-offs. They rip off smaller bands all the time, you know? And I can tell you that, you know, Eric Clapton would be the first guy to tell you, well, those licks I took from this guy. He wrote a lot of the early riffs that Clapton ended up using. I don't remember the guy's name. He's an unknown guy. But a lot of the bigger bands will be like, hey, I could take from this guy because no one would ever believe that I didn't come up with this myself, right? So I think a lot of it was like a lot of the, because like Queensrÿche was popular and they were getting on there on the charts and multi-platinum on that record and everything, but there were bands that had been around a lot longer that were copying them. They had sold more albums historically because they were older bands, Aerosmith being one of them. Aerosmith, I believe, copied them with the string section stuff. Guns N' Roses did the same thing. You listen to November Rain, you know. I think a lot of these bands copied what Queensrÿche was doing. That's my perspective. I could be wrong on that, but I will go out on a limb and say that 'cause I believe that's that could be true. And Queensrÿche's use of orchestration was really where I got a taste for how big you could make a song, which is it starts out as a simple riff and just make it movie soundtrack epic proportions, big sounding. And I think that's probably what may have led to my feeling underwhelmed at. I went to Darien Lake, New York, is where it was. They had turned it into a Six Flags park later on. Actually, it was at that point. And the stage was huge. And it was an outdoor venue. And there was about 50 rows. And then there was a fence in the back where all the general admission people were, right? And so we got tickets where we were just beyond the middle section of the concert. And it's like Rob Halford gets on there. And he's like, yeah. He's just like, I mean, it's just like, you know, borderline screaming banshee stuff. And I'm thinking, this guy still got it, man. This guy's more intense right now with his own stuff and with a solo album than he ever was with Judas Priest. And so, I mean, Breaking the Law, I mean, that's a lot of his vocals aren't super over the top on that. But at any rate, what I'm trying to say is that. I remember watching, I saw Michael Wilton up there and playing really awesome solos and stuff, and he sounded great, but Jeff Tate did not sound great, and Kelly Gray did not sound great, and it just, he kind of had cement shoes. He didn't move around a whole lot, and
He flavored. I think one thing that stood out to me the most. I happened to see. I've seen actually Queensrÿche quite a few times. The first time I saw him with Heart. The second time I saw them, they were doing the Promised Land tour, which was just freaking phenomenal. If you had a chance to see that one, they actually one of their songs. They turned the whole entire stage into a bar. They had an actual bar there. They had tables and chairs. They had pulled people from the crowd to sit at the tables, and the band themselves dressed up in suits, and they were like the house band playing the song, and Jeff was at the bar singing. singing the tune. I mean, the ambiance that they used to catch you in with, not just the music but the stage show. And yeah, I was a little underwhelmed and disappointed a little bit, thinking, oh, I'm going to see Queensryche. Yeah, the Q2K album is different, but you never know what you're going to get when you hear it live, right? Because
Right.
sometimes you can capture the music recording, but when you see it live, it hits you differently, and I don't know how else to explain that. So I was pumped. I was looking forward to it. I was thinking, yeah, Mike Wilton, Eddie Jackson, Scott Rockenfield, Jeff is going to hit those high notes. They're going to just come out and they're going to just, stomp a hole in the frickin' roof. And it was the same thing. They played a ton of stuff off their Q2K, and some of the stuff that they did cover from earlier on, I mean, Wilton obviously knows the songs and he knows the solos, and he's a founding member of the band. Kelly Gray, I think he could play the rhythm riffs really well. I think what was disappointing is I was expecting to hear, the Chris DeGarmo solos played as close to the Chris DeGarmo solos as you would come to expect when you saw the band live, right? When I go and hear a band, I understand that, there's going to be different variants or different little flares to the solos. They're not going to play it 100%, right? But at least play it 70 or 80, 85% of the way to, and hit the highlights of the solo that make that song, kind of what it is for that section, right? Some of the buildups that you
Right.
get in the solos just send it, the atmosphere and a stratosphere, but boom, you're just nailing it out of the park. Because the solo is almost like the extent of the song itself and what Jeff's singing, and then you get that solo on top of it, you're just like, yeah, this is gonna pump me up even more. And I think he took too much wah and too much delay on playing the solos, and I don't think that he could play at the caliber that Chris was at. And I'm not saying that you have to play exactly like Chris DeGarmo, because Chris DeGarmo's gonna play like Chris DeGarmo and no one else is going to. We've talked about that on some of our other podcasts, right? Your hands are different than mine, and when you play someone's solo, it's gonna sound a little bit different. That's just the way it is. But when you don't take the time to at least try to focus on the highlights of the solo that stand out, and then you try to cover it up with wah or delay, it's kind of a letdown.
It is, yeah.
I've heard some people are like, you know what? Just throw some wah on it, dude. It won't matter. It sounds great with a wah. You can really shred on the guitar with a wah. It's like, yeah, you're
It's
getting
almost too
away.
easy, though. It's almost too easy, and
It's, yeah, you can get
yeah.
away with missed notes fluff because you're rocking the wah pedal, and it's already waving that sound or that note with that wah. So to me, it was disappointing. Not that they didn't do a good job, not that they didn't put on a decent show, but yeah, it was not the Queensryche that I come to know and, got passionate about. So there was definitely a disappointment there.
Yeah, that's the thing is, I felt like when I watched that tour, when I saw them on that tour, like Michael Wooten got pushed to the back, and like he was standing in the back, like even when he's playing a lead, they treated him like a rhythm guitarist, and I was so upset because I'm like, this is no, this is the guy, you know? And you know, with Chris DeGarmo, they had that twin guitar attack, it was just awesome, and with him not there, I'm like, yeah, they definitely suffered. And you know what? And I'm not trying to bash anyone on a podcast or any of those guys. They're all great in their own right, but I just think that the recipe was not the formula, I should say, was not what I was used to, I guess. And it's unfortunate that they couldn't keep that lineup together. And but it was still cool to see like Eddie Jackson and Jeff Tate and Michael Wilton there. And I don't know if Rockenfeld wasn't playing drums at that time, was he? He was still in the band, right?
Yeah,
Would they...
he's been in the band the whole time up until recently, and we'll get to that because I want to kind of cover some of the other
Okay.
people that they
Yeah.
had in the band.
Because the drums were solid, man. They still sounded really good. So maybe that being said, why don't you segue into that, and if you want, and we'll talk about that. Because it seemed like he was in and out a couple times, I recall. He left once.
They've had, I think he's taken a leave of absence, at least that's what they're calling it now. He had another kid, and he left. Oh God, this must have been 4 years ago,
But
where he said he.
Brian Tichy was on drums, right, for a long time.
No, they've had Scott up until recently, where they had the drummer from Camelot. that has come in and backfilled for it when they do live shows. So let me take a step back here. I want to go through some of the other guitar player changes. To finish up with Kelly Gray, I think it was comfortability for Jeff, definitely, because Kelly and him played in a band in the early 80s called Myth before Jeff decided to join Queensryche. But then Gray didn't last very long after that, too. They put the Q2K album out, and then they did a live, show that covered an extent of their albums. And I've seen them on that tour. And it's the same thing. It was missing something. And then Kelly, I guess, apparently for whatever reasons, he wasn't in the band anymore. So then they got a gentleman named Mike Stone. I thought he played, I think, B-52 amps. And
they sound like throw up.
He definitely had his own style, right? And even with him, he was in the band for, I don't know, a couple years. And that's around the time that I think the dynamics of the band were really hitting hard as far as writing goes. They, after Q2K, they tried to do an album called Tribe. And
yeah, I remember that, yeah.
I was super excited because the first thing I heard was they got Chris DeGarmo back, right? And he was in the studio with them. And I was just all – it was like all the rage, right? Like, hey, man, we got the band back together, bro. Yeah, And I was just like thinking, sweet, I can't wait to hear this. And then you hear, well, they're going to tour on the album, and there's no confirmation that Chris is going to be touring with them. And the next thing you know, Chris isn't in the band. Chris isn't touring with them. Chris has writing credits for, I think, three of the songs on the Tribe album. And that was it. You don't hear from Chris again. And there was rumor out there that, they were trying to get Chris back in the band. There was, tension and conflict again. There's been rumors that Jeff's wife, Susan Tate, kind of started running a lot of the things that Chris used to do and kind of put her twist into that, however you want to look at it.
Sure.
So, that album comes out. Mike Stone's on it. That's when they picked him up. And it definitely had more of an alternative flavor, sound to it. And I think Chris was getting more into the Seattle scene and the music scene around there because he's friends with the guys from Alice in Chains. He did a one-shot album with the singer from Sponge, Sean Kinney from Alice in Chains, and Mike Inez called Spies for Darwin. It's not a really known album. Go and check it out. It's different. It's definitely an alternative type sound in music. But, like I said, Stone coming into the band, I would kind of expect that the next album they put out was going to have a different sound to it and have some of his influences. And then they put out Operation Mindcrime 2. I was kind of stoked because the first album, the concept album, was just mind-blowing, as you had stated, right? I mean, it was – they hit all their cylinders. The band was clicking. The music is just phenomenal. And then that album comes out, and I'm looking at the writing credits, and it's Jason Slater, who I think was the bass player for Three Eye Blind.
Jeez Louise.
So, and I'm looking down the credits, and there's no Mike Wilton, there's no Eddie Jackson, there's no Scott Rockenfield, there's nobody else from the band.
There goes the band, yeah.
Right? And it's like, well, what's going on here? Are you hiring guns to come in and play for the band? Is now Queensryche just an a promo name for you to go out and grab whoever you want and make an album and throw it out there?
And by the way, I was mistaken, Ben. You just mentioned hired guns. Like the Jeff Tate's band Operation Mindcrime, Brian Tichy was the drummer of that band.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
So,
okay,
my bad.
No, it's all good. They've had so many different changes in.
Well, that's what I was saying. I was like, they had a revolving door there for a while, and I know that. The turmoil that you had just recently here in the last few minutes laid out. I mean, and that was the thing is like, for me, I kind of quit listening to him because it wasn't the original lineup, and I'm not trying to be a snob, but like the stuff I had heard from him, I'm like, this, like when I listened, here's what turned me off. When I listened to Live at the Moor or Mindcrime at the Moor or whatever it was called, that live album.
Yeah.
Oh, it was terrible. The mobile recording, the production was horrible. Their amps sounded terrible. It was just very dry, and it just I just didn't like the playing. And those B-52 amps sounded just atrocious. And I was like, Yeah, I was just like blown away. I'm like, it was a mere shell of the band was a shell of what it was.
So you
And
should take a couple seconds and look up and see who did the production and recording on that, engineering.
Kelly Gray, right?
I'm not saying nothing.
No, no, I remember from the credits, you know, yep. And I'm not bashing anybody, but it's hard to get a good sound for a recording. I've been to the Moore Theater. I've sat through a concert at the Moore Theater. It's not a comfortable place to be.
No,
the acoustics are very challenging. I've been in the backstage area at the Moore. Okay?
Live sound is very hard to capture.
That venue is especially hard.
Yes. Yep. And I'm with you. Everybody has their own style, playing style, writing style. Kelly has his own thing. I've met the guy twice. You know, he has his thing he's doing, and I have to give him props. He's produced and engineered and recorded Candlebox, their first two albums, and was a huge fan of their stuff as well.
Excellent.
Candlebox's first album, the sound of it, the recording of it, the guitar sound, everything.
Well, the production's fantastic.
It's awesome. And Kelly, you know, he knows what he's doing when it comes to that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I can see your point with the live album. In Jeff's vocals definitely changed, you know. I don't know if that was because when Chris was in the band, Chris would challenge him to do more or do different things. I don't know. I can only imagine that creativity that you used to have and the people that you bounce things off of. It changes, right?
Yeah, it's just the sound especially. It's just the whole thing morphs. And it's always kind of like, I mean, you can't catch, it's like catching lightning in a bottle, you know. But I mean, because, hey, you know, musicians are human beings just like anybody else, and you know, there could be health issues, there could be emotional issues, what have you. I've already kind of lined out, and you know, time takes its toll. I mean, we can't be 23 years old the rest of our lives, so it either in body or attitude or spirit, you know, toils of life take their toll, and it's just there's a lot of factors. It's also just the quality of personnel. I mean, think about it. If you're a band who was like charting, you're at least near, you know, top in the rock charts, you're going to have the industry's best work. But when you're a band who's been out for a while, and let's just get real here, you're not going to have that kind of backing. And when you don't have the kind of backing, you can't expect that same level of like quality, right? And it's not, I'm not bashing anyone, I'm just getting real with the amount of money being thrown at something. And in the music business, it's all about money. And if you got more money to produce a record or whatever, it's going to be better.
It'll be shined up like a nice turd polish sometimes, right?
Yeah, like Def Leppard polish, like, you know, I mean, which is too polished in my opinion. And that was my thing, man. Creedence, their older albums, they found a really good way to take what's would almost sound like a raw recording, and it was just great. I mean, I just, who knows, maybe they'll bury the hatchet or something, and maybe if they ever get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I don't think they are currently, are they?
No, I don't think they are.
I mean, who knows if they'll ever make it. I mean, there's a lot of bands that should be, they'll never make it, but that's a separate podcast, and not a bad idea, by the way. And so, yeah, we'll see what happens.
It makes you wonder, right? After Mike Stone was let go, they've got a gentleman, Parker Lundgren, and when Jeff kind of started branching out, creating Wine, and I went actually, I went down and saw him at the, you know, inaugural first opening of his Insignia Wine, and he had Scott Rockenfield on drums, Jason Slater on bass, and two guys that I didn't even know, you know, who they were on guitar, and Parker was one of them, and you know, I remember watching them play, and it seemed like Parker kind of had more of a grasp on some of the Queensryche songs and knew them, you know, a little bit better than the other gentlemen. Not to say that, you know, they sounded bad at all. They did a good job. And then next thing you know, Parker's in the band, right? And then I think that's when it really kind of started getting geared up for Jeff getting fired from the band. I don't know all the details, the turmoil that was going on. I've heard other conversations, rumors about the fact that, you know, Jeff's wife was kind of running the show, running the band, and the rest of the band people were getting tired of not being able to write music and have it on the albums are being taken seriously. That Mike showed up at one time, and this is, like I said, this is all stuff I've read, so take it for what it is. It's not 100% accurate. It's probably maybe false, maybe it isn't, but I can only imagine when I've started a band and I've been in it for years and I'm trying to bring music to the table and I've been a founding member and none of it shows up on an album and you've got writing credits going to people that aren't in the band, that would really start to frustrate the crap out of me, right? When you're a musician, you want to write and you want to put your music into what you're doing, and then you want to put it out there. Fast forward a couple months, I'm watching them live on TV, and Jeff Tate tells the crowd that they suck, right? And I'm like, wait a second, this isn't the type of band that I've seen. Jeff has never been aggressive toward a crowd. He's always been respectful and thanks the crowd for showing up. And I'm like thinking, dude, you're doing a job that some people would adore and love just to be on a stage that size for one, and two, you're out touring, right? It
So let me
crowd.
get this straight. Let me get this straight. So you were at this gig, right?
No, I was watching it. It was on TV. It was on national TV.
Oh gosh.
They were in
So where
Rocklahoma.
was this? Where was this gig?
It was in Rocklahoma, so it was in Oklahoma, and it was like a
Wow.
festival.
I know what festival you're talking about.
So
Yeah, I know that festival well. They have like Warrant and some of those other bands.
they
They'd
yeah, they
show
were.
up. Yeah. They got lumped in with the 80s hair metal crowd, and he probably doesn't care for that. And he probably didn't want to be there, and he probably didn't like the crowd. He's probably just there. That crowd there is different, and it's definitely not something people he's not used to entertaining. And it's a rough show, I'll be honest with you, Ben.
Well, I guess, and okay, that's one perspective. I'm gonna agree, but I'm gonna disagree with you.
Sure.
I've played shows to three people. I've played shows to no people. I've played shows to a 12-year-old, a 6-year-old who would dance to, rooms that were packed. If you love what you do, you go and you do it, and you do the best you can at it, right? You're not necessarily there for trying to make sure that every single person in the venue is going to like what you do because they
Oh, I'm
won't.
not justifying what he did. I was just trying to come up with maybe some factors that contributed to atrocious behavior like that, because I would never in a million years ever tell a crowd, and that's a pretty ballsy move, because
On
you
national
do that.
TV?
Yeah,
Yeah.
and you know what? Your bus is parked out there in the back, and guess what? They know where you parked that bus.
Let's see if you're
Okay.
driving away now.
Yeah,
Yeah.
you're not going anywhere on flat tires,
Yeah,
and that's dangerous.
and it's not that they didn't, it's not that they didn't sound bad. They sounded good, but the other thing I noticed about that show, the band members were not moving across the stage at all.
Yeah, cement
Everybody's
shoes. Yeah.
stayed in their one spot, and that was it. And then I don't know if it was a week later, 2 weeks later, I had heard, and this was all over the news, that Jeff had spit on during a concert on Scott Rockenfield and his drums, and that he almost went fisticuffs with Mike Wilton.
Fisticuffs. These are guys in their 50s.
And
Oh gosh, fisticuffs.
so whatever the chaos was going on behind the scenes, I think the crack finally split at that point, right? There had been so much change, so many people coming and going, so many changes on who's in charge, not in charge, people not obviously being respected for the musicianship that they can do. And it came to a boil point, and the majority tried to fire Jeff. And there was a whole entire, I don't know how long it lasted. It must have been at least a year. And I think the final outcome was Jeff could use the name, Jeff Tate, the original singer from Queensryche, for a year. And out of the deal, he got the fact that he could play Operation Mindcrime in its entirety, as where the actual band Queensryche, who will keep the name Queensryche, couldn't play Operation Mindcrime from front to back anymore. Like, they can't play the whole entirety of it in a
Right.
row. And so during the whole process of all that stuff going on, the original members put a show together, and they named the band Rising West. And they wanted to play that earlier stuff that you were talking about. And I want to kind of
Right.
loop this back in because I think that was important what you said, that you went and saw a show where you knew they can play heavier stuff and they can play that metal or that, that era of the British metal and the Iron Maiden style stuff they were doing. they actually put together this band to go and do that. And they got Todd LaTorre to come in and sing. And that guy, I've had a chance to see them live with him. He is no joke. That guy is a singer, a musician. He plays guitar. He plays drums. I was blown away because he could hit all those high notes that Jeff couldn't do anymore. So when he came out on stage, and he nails the intro to Queen of the Reich, which is – that's a no joke, you know, going up the musical note scale at the beginning of that song. I was floored. Absolutely floored.
He's kind of like a fresh start with that guy.
Yeah. You know, you're not getting a young buck. You know, he's been in a band before. You know, I can't remember the name of the band he was in prior to Queensryche. I'll have to look that up. But, you know, he's been around the block. He plays music, and, you know, he's kept his vocals in shape, you know?
Yeah.
You can tell he's fit. He's into his craft, and he knows what that is, and he knows what he wants out of it. And, I was floored when I saw him live. They were phenomenal, like they were back in the heyday.
That singer seems like a really nice guy, too.
He's got an interesting perspective. I think, you know, I've seen some of his posts on social media. I think he's got one of those kind of senses of humor that he'll post something just to post it because he thinks it's funny, but it could be offensive to somebody, right?
I had heard he told Jim's story how, like, well, I never really thought I was that great of a singer, but, you know, I just decided to go sing because he was a guitarist. And I think he was on Eddie Trunk, I believe. Yeah, it was Eddie Trunk. And Eddie Trunk interviewed him, and he's just like, yeah, I didn't ever expect anything to be a lead vocalist because I was a guitar player.
Drummer,
is that what he was? Primarily drums, right?
Yeah, he was doing drums.
That's right. Okay. So, yeah, he said, I'm primarily drummer and everything. And it was like, I was like, that's pretty cool, you know, and you end up doing something you never thought you'd be doing, and that's true to life. And I just thought he had a cool origin story, and he was humble in it, so that's what I refer to. And, you know, it's that's my thing. I was just blown away. I thought it was really neat to hear someone, you know, and there's a lot of guys that are, in this day and age, there's a lot of really decent players out there that aren't total jerks. So, I mean, it's not like the 80s used to. The '80s, what was like, if they're not coked up, their ego is like way through the roof, and that's why you can never have a band that's stuck together longer than 2 hours.
Or their voice lasts long enough. Some of those guys from the '80s, you hear them now, and then just it's rough.
Dave Coverdale, I mean, he can't hit anything anymore.
But you know, like you said, age, time, you know, you're not going to be a spring chicken anymore.
That's just it's wear and tear. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, Todd has got a solo album out now. Which is it's metal. It's no joke. It's different than the Queensryche style of stuff. But you know, I think that the guitar player on there does an awesome job. I think, you know, Todd's definitely making an effort for the metal arena with that album. I encourage anybody to go and listen to it. There's a particular track on there that I really like. Can't remember the name of it. I'll have to look it up here. But it reminded me a lot of Bruce Dickinson's style of singing is what kind of stood out to me, and I was just like, wow, this guy's got some massive range on what he can.
Yeah.
And he was with Crimson Glory from 2010 to 2013.
Yep, that's an interesting band. Yeah, there's a song, there's an album they had called Astronomica, which interesting, definitely very concept. So
yeah, and then you know, obviously getting into Queensryche. His solo project is called Rejoice in the Suffering. The song that really stands out to me is Crossroads to Insanity. I think it definitely has a lot of flavor. He does sing his own style to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can tell it's Todd LaTorre, but it reminds me of that, you know, that Bruce Dickinson, Iron Maiden, you know, that early metal vibe to it, which is just great.
Well, and if you listen to like Nevermore, that band Nevermore, their first album there, maybe it was their second album. But that vocalist there was amazing too. He had a very, very Jeff Tate kind of style, you know, at least with the vibrato in his voice. You know, I often thought about like, you listen to like some, when they just talk regular dialogue, they've got deep voices, you know, and then they can hit this, they can actually pass the mid range and go up to a high end. A lot of it is how you position your words, how you're able to kind of flex your vocal muscles, so to speak. But like we've stated previously, they've got a limited mileage. So.
Well, you gotta. It's like anything, you know. In my opinion, if you've got a guitar, you gotta take care of it, right? Are you gonna
Yeah.
have that guitar forever? Well, chances are you're gonna need to tune it up. You're gonna probably have to maybe get a fret job on it. You know, there's a lot of things that you do to keep, you know, your skills up. You gotta practice. You gotta do what you gotta do. To me, vocals aren't really any different. It's just a different type of instrument, right? You gotta take care of your voice. You gotta keep. Yep. There you
Stainless
go.
steel frets, baby. Stainless steel. Way to go. Yeah.
But I mean, you get what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
You gotta take the time and effort to take care of what you're trying to do. It's like I'm not gonna go out and, you know, grab a hammer and start bashing my hand every single day and expect to be able to play
Unless you're the
guitar.
guy who that Paul Timmerman guy from he does those DIY hardware things on Mad TV. We're gonna keep working on that Lazy Susan we started last week. I had to throw some comedy in there tonight, man. It's so great.
Good stuff.
Welcome back to Paul Timmerman's workshop. Get the nail gun.
Oh, good
Oh,
stuff.
that's great. Yeah. Anyway, so
So yeah, going back to Todd, check out that "Rejoice the Suffering" or "Rejoice in the Suffering" song. The guitar solo on there is, to me, is it's great. It's really well done. A gentleman named Jordan Ziff did the solo on that track.
to
Check it
check that
out.
out. Yeah,
Yeah,
absolutely.
absolutely. Jinx. So,
Like it.
Scott Rockenfield, we'll come back. That was the question. He said if he was in and out of the band. Yeah, he took a leave of absence because he had a baby. And I, you know, obviously he's not a spring chicken himself. He's rather up there, and you know, these guys have been around since the 80s. So he took time off to be around his kid, you know. And I just read,
That's
I
cool.
think it was on Eddie Trunk, that he hasn't talked to Scott in years. He just he took that leave of absence, and they're like, yeah, he's not out of the band. We just don't know when he's coming back, and he's not said. And then, you know, obviously speculation and rumors and stuff are gonna fly like they always do. And the last comment from Scott Rockenfield, he posted saying, "No, I'm not out of the band. More to come." And what that means, I don't know. Does that mean that, you know, maybe they're gonna go through another, you know, case where they gotta go to court? You know, I don't know. It would suck because I happen to think that Scott's drums are amazing. Obviously, you know, just being a huge fan, but I think he's got mad talent. You know, everybody in that band, you know, is just developed into great musicians in their own right. I mean, even Eddie Jackson, I think he's just a phenomenal bass player.
Yeah, that tone, that video you sent me of their behind the scenes, his bass tone was like, oh man, it just totally cuts through the mix. It's awesome.
Yeah, he plays an NS2 Spector, which used to be Kramer, right? And then
Right.
Spector bought him out, and then you know, he plays a Spector NS2. He plays Hartke bass amps,
Those are
and
really nice, yeah.
yeah, and he has a P&J EMG pickup set up on his bass.
Yeah.
So
Well, he was an Ampeg guy for a long time, wasn't he?
I think he's always done Hartke. I think the basses he's played have changed throughout the years. In the 80s, he did the Spector bass. In the 90s, late 90s, I think it was, oh gosh, I can't remember what they're called. And then he like promoted Fernandez basses for a minute.
Those are pretty nice guitars.
Yeah, and then I don't know. I'll have to double check and see what he's on to. I know he plays a five string now, prominently, when
Oh,
I've seen.
wow. Yeah. Yeah, it's always funny too because it was like there's always been it's kind of like skate with 4-string or 5-string players. It's always like the skiers versus the snowboard. It was like Billy Sheehan, is great. He's like the king of lead bass, right? At least in my opinion. And he's like, for all you 5-string players out there, he goes, good for you, but for
Just kind of like, eh, yeah, all
Yeah,
right, good
he
for you,
goes,
buddy.
but four. He goes, four is enough for me, so it does what I need. And it was great. He's just such a down to earth guy. But that's a separate podcast. We need to do. I want to do a whole podcast about Billy Sheehan. It'd be awesome.
We should
But
do
anyway.
that with bass players because I think, you know, we need to cover them. They might only have four strings. There's the awesome joke that, you know, what do you do if you can't play guitar? You play bass, you know, or those that can play guitar and those that don't play bass.
They teach Jim, yes.
Teach Jim. No, but bass players deserve notoriety, you know, just as much as guitar
Dude,
players
there's some
do.
awesome. Dude, I love bass, and to me, there's certain things about like what bass players have done in the last 30 years to push the instrument. And Michael Anthony's bass solo, he did a Jack Daniel's bass solo on the Van Halen live right here right now. He did this really awesome. It's a he did. There was a song off Fair Warning called. Oh, I think it's Sunday Afternoon in the Park or something like that, and he's got this bass overdrive just raging. Well, he went ahead and did that on that album, and it just he had bass chorus on there, but it was the bass distortion was so great. But anyway, yeah, I definitely want to do that. Was there anything about Queensryche that you want to cover before we wrap this up?
If you haven't listened to them, give them a chance. You know, definitely listen to the first Operation Mindcrime. Great concept album, great musicianship. Empire obviously is huge. If you really want to kind of go back further,
Rage for
I
Order
would.
is great.
Yeah. It, well. Yeah. It's it's
It's an awesome album. It's so cool. And
it's it's
I
pivotal.
love it.
I think it's
Yeah.
pivotal in their career. Right, it's pivotal in
Yeah.
their musicianship, and you can really tell the jump from The Warning to that one, and then going into Mindcrime. Now they're great. I can't say enough about the band. What they're doing now with Todd is it's good stuff. It's definitely getting back more into the more aggressive tone and sound that they've done before. Obviously, it's still going to be different than when Chris was in the band, because it's not going to have Chris DeGarmo's flavor to it. But it's definitely
Sure.
worth listening to and checking out for sure. And hopefully they'll just keep putting more and more music out, but I'd like to find out what happened to Scott. Absolutely. So yeah, check Queensryche out, check Todd LaTorre's stuff out, and enjoy the music.
And just as a little bit of a teaser for what I want to do on our next episode, speaking of awesome bass players, Mr. Greg Chiasson, that guy was awesome. He was when he played in Badlands. Oh man, there's some live gigs they did, and I think there's a Montreal gig they did in '89. That guy had some freaking stage presence. Oh my gosh, I mean the guy's super tall. He's a big guy, and just his stage presence and everything was so cool. And there's an opening bass segment to one of their songs. It's the first song on their set list, and it's like it's just it's total lockstep with the drums. He had Eric Singer on drums. Oh man, I'm telling you, it's so cool. So after this, Ben, I want to show you that video, but we're gonna touch on Badlands, and what I'd like to do is reach out and see if we can get Mr. Chiasson on the show. I think that'd be great.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, he's running a guitar shop in Arizona, so he has his own guitar shop. So I really want to go. I want to try and get a hold of him. He'd be an awesome guy to talk to. And he came out with a solo album here. I think it was before COVID, I believe. And I want to check that out too. They had a Facebook page, and they were selling it through Facebook. So I really want to check that out. And I guess it's got a real 70s heavy rock sound too. He said it was like Led Zeppelin and Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, Rainbow kind of stuff. So I definitely want to check that out. But anyway, yeah. Great show tonight, Ben, and excellent. I love hearing your knowledge on Queensryche and your fandom as well. And definitely an excellent topic. And this won't be the last time we're talking, of course.
Yeah,
And
there's no way. I mean, they're still writing music, and to me, they're still influential. I think they deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. And
we've only scratched the surface. So podcasts have their limits, you know. So
time limits.
absolutely, yeah.
I can
So
go on for hours.
you got anything else, Ben, or are we gonna sail
No,
off into the sunset here?
we're riding off into the sunset. Just want to say thanks to people that are listening to this. We appreciate you taking the time out and enjoying what we're doing. Feel free to hit us up on Twitter, ask us questions, you know, leave us comments. You know, if you think that we're, you know, way off base, hey, we've had people write questions like, why do you hate this? But
Due to
definitely
my comments, mostly.
that's okay. You know what? It's okay to have an opinion. In this day and age, it might be questioned, but you know what? That's what makes you unique. Yeah, definitely. Let us know if you have comments. Let us know if there's questions you want us to have answered. You know, we like to interact with people And hopefully we'll have, like you're saying, some pretty cool guests on that will be fun to talk to, that have been in the music business for sure.
Yeah, we're definitely out in the prowl, folks. We are making efforts to reach out to certain individuals, and you know how it is. It's always schedules, availability, and the like. Even in the COVID stuff, and just real quick, I've noticed a lot of these artists have fill up their time doing other types of they're doing master classes, they're doing in studio concerts, streaming concerts, things of that nature to adapt. So a lot of these guys are busy. Yeah, well, we'll keep cranking on it, and we appreciate all of you for listening tonight. And yeah, thanks a lot, everybody. And you all have a wonderful weekend coming up, and we'll talk to you next time.
Enjoy. See ya.